Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Baseball and St. Louis go together like beer and brats. It's nothing new. The marriage between the city and baseball goes way back, well more than 130 years. That was a time when the sport was just getting its legs, and when the owner of a St. Louis team called the Browns, not to be confused with a more recent Browns team, was pitching beer as much as baseball. The players were rascals, drunks, and tough. You had to be able to be tough to be playing hurt and without a glove and on pebbled infields. The owners and managers were also tough and colorful, and one in particular may have actually saved the game. He owned the team that became the St. Louis Cardinals, and maybe the city's most important baseball man most here have never heard of. The story is told in a most interesting history for baseball fans. The word fans itself, by the way, was coined here. I'm Don Marsh. We're talking with the author Edward Acorn about his new book, The Summer of Beer and Whiskey, How Brewers, Barkeeps, Rowdies, Immigrants, and a Wild Pennant Fight Made Baseball America's Game. Ed joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Ed, nice to have you with us.
Don, it's great to be here.
I want to tell you, I love the book, and I think everybody in St. Louis, as well as baseball fans everywhere, would as well.
Thank you so much.
You know, before starting to talk about some of the specifics of the book, as we were talking about just before we went on the air, this is really a time to be thinking about baseball in a somewhat different way. You're up in the Boston area. You've just gone through the horror that community and the nation has gone through up there. And we kind of look to baseball, as we've done in the past, to bring us back together, don't we?
I think we do. It's one of those things that helps us heal. And this happened after the Civil War. It happened, you know, during World War II. Baseball helped keep us together during that war. That's why Roosevelt kept it going. And, you know, last weekend, I don't know if you saw any of the footage from the ceremony in Boston, but it was very, very moving, I thought, at Fenway Park. And it just brings us together. It's something that binds us together as Americans.
Yeah, it was a very important time, too, after 9/11, when baseball returned after a very brief hiatus, and it was important to get back into that kind of routine.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Well, we're here to talk about the book and about a gentleman by the name of Chris Von der A. Tell us about this guy, who he was, what he was like, and some of the things that he did.
Well, he's a wonderful figure. I think of him as sort of a combination of Charlie Finley, Bill Veeck, and George Steinbrenner.
Wow.
With some Yogi Berra thrown in for fun. But he came from Westphalia in Germany in the 1860s, and then he settled in St. Louis. He had a grocery and a saloon out back, and this was on Grand Avenue at the corner of St. Louis Avenue. And he began to notice that there's a ballpark down the street and people are playing baseball there, and he sort of picks up business on days when people are in the neighborhood. And eventually he decided the game had gotten to such a low point it was almost dead, and this is a major theme of the book, but gambling, corruption, and other problems had almost killed the national game. It was quite amazing. And he decided to invest his life savings in baseball after all these native-born Americans had tried and failed to make it a go of it in St. Louis. He decided to invest his life savings, and he sort of bought the team and turned it into a huge success and made millions of dollars. And he had a wonderful formula of selling lots of beer at the ballpark. Essentially, he bought the team so he could sell more beer. He wanted to make a killing selling beer at the ballpark, and he did that. He charged low admission prices, 25 cents, which was half the going rate for the National League. And he had baseball on Sunday, which was very important because immigrants or working people, these people work 6 days a week, very, very tough life back then, long hours, 6 days a week. And the only day, really, they could go out and enjoy themselves was on a Sunday. So he drew huge crowds on Sundays.
And that in itself was kind of risky, was it not? Certainly the working class needed that time off and needed the relaxation, but there were those who would look upon Sunday games with disapproval.
Oh, yes. The East Coast establishment looked down on St. Louis because it was a little different from the rest of the country. Here in St. Louis, people mainly because of the French Catholic and also the German immigrants enjoyed their Sundays. They liked getting out and enjoying recreation. And part of that was drinking beer. That was just such a great part of the German heritage. And in fact, the Germans sort of turned us into a beer-drinking nation and brought that to baseball, too, as I mentioned. So it was a little risky. Vandere would occasionally get in trouble with the law for having Sunday games, but he seemed to have enough political clout that he could keep that under control. And eventually, you know, baseball turned to Sunday games and beer.
Well, he was looked upon rather disparagingly by a lot of people because of his thick accent and the fact that he dressed rather flamboyantly. He was subject to some ridicule.
Oh, yes. There was a certain amount of, as in every era, prejudice against the latest group of immigrants. And he was portrayed somewhat as this bombastic German fool. But I think he played on that image and enjoyed it and used it as a way to get into the papers. And he's just, I mean, the stories about him are just wonderfully fun. I mean, he loved this his third baseman, Arlie Latham, who he said was so fast he could run like a cantaloupe. And and he would just have these great sayings, like after he traded away a player who later turned out to be good, he said, "Why, oh, why didn't I listen to mine own advice?" So he's just, I think he's a wonderful character.
One of the interesting aspects of that character was the fact that he really didn't know very much about baseball.
He didn't seem to know that much. It's funny because he got into the game to sell beer, and he would get, you know, Charlie Comiskey, who's one of his star players, said when, you know, he would come into the clubhouse after a game and go up to some player and yell at him and say, "Why did you drop that ball?" As if he did it on purpose or something. So he didn't quite understand all the details of baseball, but he on the other hand, he was really clever in figuring out who would run the team well, namely Charlie Comiskey, and what kind of players to sign and what kind of deals to make. And he was a really a strong-willed, very crafty character.
Would the game have not survived, would you guess, because of the low level it had reached because of the corruption that you've mentioned? I mean, people just stopped going to the games. They lost all respect for the game.
Yeah, this is why baseball still has to be careful about gambling and, you know, Pete Rose and all that stuff. The game was very nearly killed off in the early 1880s. I mean, it had just gotten so rank with corruption. And this was true in St. Louis, and it was true in Louisville, where a gang of four players threw the pennant in 1877. So fans had gotten to the point they were sickened by that. They also didn't like the atmosphere at a lot of these ballparks. I mean, there were prostitutes working the stands and, you know, thugs are hanging around. And Vandere attacked all this stuff. He brought in honest players. He cleaned up the stands, and he made it more popular with working people. No, go ahead.
What was the structure of the game at this time in terms of leagues? You mentioned the National League, for instance, and I know that Vandere really established yet another league. Kind of fill us in on what the structure was like.
Sure. Well, the National League was founded in 1876, and it was the major league. I mean, it was it had really good players. But it charged 50 cents admission for games, which was quite expensive. It didn't permit Sunday baseball, and it didn't permit beer at the games. So along came Vandere, and he was making a great killing running this independent team, St. Louis Browns. And he decided to get together with some other owners and create a new league, which was called the American Association. And this was founded in November 1881. They met in Cincinnati and decided to form this new league. And the National League was just terrified of this. A lot of the critics called it the Beer and Whiskey League, which is what I got the title of the book from, because there were so many sort of beer interests and distillers backing these teams. And then also they were selling beer at their games. And the National League was very snooty toward this new league, upstart league, tried to kill it off, but they didn't succeed. And the American Association was just this wonderful, entertaining league. And it existed for about a decade, and then it was folded into the National League. There's four teams that have survived from the American Association. The Pittsburgh Pirates, St. Louis Cardinals, the Los Angeles Dodgers, and the Cincinnati Reds. So this league is still, in a sense, it's still in existence.
Is it too much of a stretch to say that Van der Aa did save the game? I mean, that's the way this whole thing is being promoted.
Well, it's somewhat of a stretch. I mean, God knows what would have happened. But what he did was help make it vastly more popular. I mean, as I mentioned, we had this culture that in the National League where they were just aiming for the upper middle class. They didn't care about the lower classes. Van der Aa opened this game up to a whole number of new people, including immigrants who could come to the games and see what it's about and sort of start to feel like Americans. And that really created a tremendous amount of interest in the game. And I think that regenerated Major League Baseball.
Well, we have to take a break. Ed Acorn will do that now and come back and continue our conversation. We're focusing on the year 1883, which is a transformational year in the game. And that's pretty much what your book is all about. We'll do that. The name of the book, by the way, is The Summer of Beer and Whiskey, How Brewers, Barkeeps, Rowdies, Immigrants, and a Wild Pennant Fight Made Baseball America's Game. We'll come back and continue this conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Ed Acorn, the author of The Summer of Beer and Whiskey, subtitled How Brewers, Barkeeps, Rowdies, Immigrants, and a Wild Pennant Fight Made Baseball America's Game. And St. Louis played a huge role in that, as you have been hearing during the first part of our discussion. You know, I think a lot of people are confused by the fact that we were talking initially about the St. Louis Browns, and of course there was a St. Louis Browns much later on. How does it happen that they were the Browns and not the Cardinals?
Yeah, that is confusing, and that requires some explanation. But what happened was the team was originally known as the St. Louis Browns, and then gradually they stopped using that name. Nicknames for teams changed all the time in the 19th century and early 20th century. Like the Boston Red Sox were known as the Boston Pilgrims for a time and that sort of thing. So what happened was the St. Louis, I guess because they started wearing red, became known as the Cardinals. When the American League came along and wanted a competing team, they chose the name the Browns just because it was such a popular name and it had such a great legacy in the city.
And they wore brown stockings. They were actually the Brown stockings, were they not?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And what one of the things Van der Aa did was in 1883 changed the stockings to red. So he was sort of even thinking very early on of what the colors of the team would become, but they changed them back to brown after the season for some reason.
We have an email question from a gentleman named Steve who asks, Van der Aa was a national celebrity in his day, but why don't St. Louisans know about him?
Well, a lot of early baseball has been forgotten, and this is one of the things I love about it. It's real baseball, but these stories need to be dug out and retold, and they're just wonderful stories. I mean, it's just amazing. Any era of baseball you look at, it tells you so much about the culture of the time, what America was like, what it was going through, what people were like at that time. And that's why I just love early baseball, and I wanted to pull him out and let his story be told. I think he belongs in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. He's not there, but I think he belongs there for what he did for this game. And he's just a marvelous, marvelous figure, not only for what he did, but for what a funny character he is. He was a terrible womanizer. I write about how at one game his girlfriend was sitting in the grandstand and his first wife came over and clubbed her on the head with a bottle of soda. So he dealt with issues like that along with everything else. But the reason people forget about early baseball is just it sort of faded and nobody wrote about it for a while because it was so hard to dig up all the facts and figures. And nowadays, with our access to the internet and to digital banks of newspapers, now we can reach back and tell these stories a little better. Well, I think they deserve to be told.
Indeed, they do. And I want to talk to you about your sources. But first, let's take a phone call from Memphis, Tennessee. I think you may have answered Jay's question, but he may ask for elaboration, perhaps.
Sure.
Jay, has the question about the Hall of Fame been answered to your satisfaction?
Pretty much, but I just wanted to tell Ed how much I enjoyed his first book, 59 and 84. And my question, I guess I could change the question, is what do you think Chris Fonderai would be remembered for today?
What he would be remembered for? Just a number of things. I mean, founding the St. Louis Cardinals, that's big. Founding this league, helped founding a major league, that's very big. Just in terms of adding color and life to the game, he had fireworks at the ballpark. At nights. He loved fireworks. Now, this was obviously not during games, but he brought this whole spirit of showmanship to baseball. He had the team line up and run to their bases. They marched in a straight line and then ran to their bases. Everything was about showmanship with him, and I think that's like a great quality he brought to the game.
You know, you mentioned Steinbrenner and Finley and Bill Veeck and others with whom he might be compared. I can see a line between him and Gussie Bush, too, because, you know,
sure.
Not only the beer connection, but Gussie was that kind of a character as well in many respects.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
All righty, let's get to that issue of sources now. Statistics abound in the game of baseball today, not so much as you've indicated in the game of many years past. Where did you get all this information? You just have a wealth of facts and figures in this book.
Well, many years ago when I was a reporter in Washington, I would go to the Library of Congress every night after work, believe it or not, and dig through old newspapers. I just loved the early game. I wanted to learn about it. And the only way you can learn about it is to go to the original sources, which are newspaper accounts of the games as they were played in 1883. And I just dug through virtually every edition of every big city paper I could find and took notes and made copies and used this as sort of the background for all this. And that's really the only way to get at early baseball is to do that kind of legwork, which I suppose is why some of these figures aren't as well known as they should be.
The writing of the sports writers of that day was quite different, was it not?
It's totally entertaining. I don't think I can find it on the fly, but they'd use wonderful language and they would insult each other as well. They'd really tear each other to shreds. There was a Cincinnati sports writer, a Louisville writer, said he reminds me of the part of the horse's anatomy that is closest to the dashboard. So they would really tear each other to shreds, and it's very fun reading these early papers and the language used.
They had no problem being partisan either. They were fans of the teams themselves.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
You bet. And they would scream it. I mean, they would lacerate umpires. They would, just have a wild time covering these teams.
One of the things that I found fascinating in the book was the fact that there were a few black ball players in those days. I mean, they predated Jackie Robinson, not to suggest in any way that Robinson's role wasn't what it was. But there were two black players that Vondre had, Fleet Walker being one of them. He was a college graduate and a pretty good ball player. But I was really surprised to find out that there were some blacks playing professional ball at that time.
Yeah, these guys, they actually played for the Toledo Club rather than St. Louis, but a lot of people don't understand that. They see the movie 42, and they think Jackie Robinson was the first. And Jackie was obviously worth all the praise he's gotten. But there were black players in the 1880s in the American Association. And you mentioned one, Moses Fleetwood Walker, who was a very talented catcher at a time when catching was really highly prized. And I could explain why later, but and he played for the Toledo Club, and then later in the season, his brother Welday came in and joined the team as well. So you have two recognized black major leaguers at the time, and in addition, there was professional black baseball, like all black teams touring the country, predating what's known as the Negro Leagues. So there was a very active movement of professional black ball players back then.
Also a very active movement called racism amongst some of the players, Cap Anson being one of them.
Yes.
You can tell part of that story if you like.
Well, yeah, sure. Walker played in an exhibition game against Cap Anson, and Anson was furious when he saw this black player on the field and he screaming the N-word and all that stuff. And the Toledo Club insisted that Walker play. At first, they were not going to play him, and then Anson made such a fit about it that they decided to play him. And Anson devoted himself for the rest of his life to making sure that blacks would not play in Major League Baseball. And he's a great player. He's in the Hall of Fame. He belongs in the Hall of Fame, but he is what he did in keeping up black players is just awful, I think. And I'm sure 90% of the players at the time were on his side. They didn't want to lose their jobs. They didn't want to run the risk of competition from black players. They felt it was degrading to the game to have black players involved in it. And so they worked hard to keep him, keep black players out. And it's one of the tragedies of the game, because I think, as Jackie Robinson showed, when the game is integrated, it sends such a powerful message that, we are all equal. And that changed the whole culture of America, I thought, when Jackie came in. And Jackie, of course, deserves all the credit he gets, because he did permanently break that color line. Moses Fleetwood Walker couldn't do it. He tried. And he was subject to incredible persecution, death threats. Very similar to Jackie, though. He was college-educated, and he had this sort of calm demeanor. He was able to take this stuff without snapping, which was very important. And he made it through the season, but then after that, they decided to just leave the blacks in the minor leagues, and then eventually force them out of that even.
And so Walker becomes really almost not even quite a footnote to baseball history, even though
But I think he's far more than a footnote. I devoted a chapter of this book to him. Mm-hmm. I think he's a remarkable figure in the story of the game. He became very bitter about America, and he argued that blacks should leave this country and settle in their own country. Maybe in Africa, but that's very sad, because he was a very bright man, very creative man, and I think the future of America had to be in a different direction of integration.
Yeah, when I speak of him as a footnote, I really mean that really nobody really knows him of him.
That's right. It's like Vondre. Nobody knows about these very important early figures, and that's one of the reasons I want to tell these stories. I think they're very important to the game.
We have, not surprisingly, a number of calls and emails, and I'd like to get to them. They're going to take us, I'll warn you this, they're going to take us all over the place. People are coming at it from many different directions. But if you're ready, we'll start taking them, and then we'll continue our conversation as well. Let's start with Heather. She's calling from Boston. Heather, thanks for being with us, and hope things are well for you in Boston these days.
Thank you very much. You know, we've been through a lot lately, and the game of baseball has certainly brought us all together, especially with Neil Diamond making the surprise appearance at the Red Sox game this weekend to sing Sweet Caroline.
Yeah, that was quite a moment.
It was. It really did bring a lot of tears and bring a lot of people a lot of good feelings after a period of grief.
Well, David Ortiz opened a few eyes and ears as well, as I recall, but that's another story.
Yes, I'm calling with a question for Ed.
Go ahead.
Ed, I am very, very much a follower of your work, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in Massachusetts when you come for your book signing and bringing my son to get my autographed copy.
Well, thank you, Heather.
And my question is regarding, I know you mentioned that there was certainly a lot of money transactions that were flowing and gambling and what have you, but did the players actually have an opportunity to make any money from the game of baseball, or did the players and the immigrants and the individuals who are actually doing the work see a penny from their efforts?
Yeah, well, players at the time made a fairly good living, but nothing like the multimillionaires today. I guess someone working in a factory 6 days a week would make about $500 a year, and these players might make $1,200 or $1,500, $2,000. Some stars made a little more than that. But you can see it wasn't dramatically different from the average person. And a lot of these ball players were just completely reckless with money. They had never seen money before. They were young men. They spent it on wine, women, and song, and they would be out of money by the end of the year, so the end of the season, so they'd have to work all winter and then come back and play baseball again. So these were not rich people, but it's kind of fun reading the newspaper coverage of the game in the 1880s, and it's just like fans today. They're complaining, oh, when I was a kid, players were in this game for the love of the game, and now all they care about is the money. So even back then, that was the case.
You know, Ed, these guys really were tough. I mean, when we think about playing the game with a hard ball without a baseball glove, as they did in those days, the infields were certainly not anything like what they are today. They were pebbled infields, as I understand it from the book.
Yeah.
You know, the equipment was not very good. They played hurt. Pitchers would pitch every other day, it would seem. Some of these guys went 600 innings during the course of a season of 100 games or so.
That's right. A lot of these pitchers wore out their arms very quickly. You know, my last book was about old Hoss Radbourne, who won 59 games in one season, if you can believe that, in a 112-game season, and he pitched 678 innings. So you can imagine what that does to the human arm. And as you mentioned, they played barehanded, which is hard to believe. It was with a hard baseball, just as hard as the one we use today. And they suffered a lot of broken fingers playing the game that way. But, you know, this was, by the standards of the time, a pretty good way to make a living. You could earn a good living. You'd be outdoors in the fresh air. You know, you wouldn't be stuck in a mine somewhere or in a hot factory, dangerous factory, or out in the fields. So these players really scrapped and fought hard to keep these jobs, and they kept them as long as they could. There were no unions or anything like that, so if they were injured on the job, a lot of the times the owners just stopped paying them. You know, no play, no pay. And so that made them inspired to keep playing when they were injured at times.
It was also interesting to note, as you did on many occasions, when the crowds really started to come in, if there wasn't enough room in the stands, they'd put the fans on the field.
Oh yeah, they'd put them out in the. They wanted the money, and they didn't care how they put the fans in the park. They would jam them in. Vondere put so many people in the upper deck at one game that it started to groan and sway and almost collapsed. If you can imagine what a disaster that would have been. Mm. So there were, you know, they played in these wooden ballparks with. That wouldn't exactly pass OSHA regulations today. When the crowd was so big, they'd put them out in the outfield behind a rope or something like that, and they'd create ground rules. Okay, a ball hit into the crowd is a ground rule double or something like that.
Well, they love to see that many fans at the ballpark. There is no question about that. But by the way, we've had a number of questions via Facebook and email. Folks wondering if this book, the one we're talking about, The Summer of Beer and Whiskey, is written in the same style as 59 and 84.
Yes, it is written in the same style. What I try to do when I write, I don't know how to write history another way, but I try to make the reader feel like you were right back there at the time and what it was like, what his arm must have felt like, that sort of thing. And I just try to bring in as much detail and color from the period to make you feel like you were right there. And I don't know, Don, if I succeeded with this new one, but that's what I was trying to do.
Oh, I think you did. I found it fascinating. And it's a wonderful history. I mean, also of some of the other things that were going on and what this city was like back in the in 1883 and during that time period. Ed, I have to take another break. I'll remind listeners that you're going to be here next week and talking about the book and signing, I'm sure, at Left Bank Books. That's Thursday, May 2nd, is when you'll be here at 7 o'clock, the Left Bank Bookstore downtown. We have a link to Left Bank Books on our website for more information about that, but stlpublicradio.org. But again, that's May 2nd at 7 p.m. at Left Bank Books. Want to come back, take more phone calls, more questions for Ed Acorn. Again, the book, The Summer of Beer and Whiskey. We'll do that in just a moment, and lots of calls coming in. We'll take them when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Ed Acorn, the author of The Summer of Beer and Whiskey. Ed, I have an email here from Ann in your neck of the woods, Wakefield, Rhode Island. She's asking two questions. How did America become the national pastime, and did immigrants have anything to do with that? Partially answered, I believe. And why was selling beer at the ballpark so important to the people of St. Louis?
Yeah, let me do the first one. Baseball was known as the national pastime very early, even really before it became the national pastime. It was a big competition with cricket, which was a very popular game, and a lot of the Americans wanted to have their own game. So they claimed that baseball was the American game, unlike cricket. And it's kind of funny looking at the early game. The reason they argued this was the American game is because baseball was so fast-paced and action-packed. And a lot of people who think it's kind of sluggish these days might be amused by that statement. But that's how baseball was. It was played in like an hour and a half. They had to race to finish it before it got dark because they had no lights at the ballpark. There were no long delays between innings because there were no broadcasting commercials. So the game was played very briskly. If some batter tried to step out of the box like they do today after every pitch, the pitcher would just either knock him down or wing the ball right over the plate, and the umpire would call a strike. They didn't wait around. They didn't fool around. So it was a very fast-paced, compelling game. And what was the second question?
Oh, let me go back to that. But let me, as I'm doing that, ask you, do you think it's still the national pastime, or is football taken
over? Well, I think clearly a number of indices suggest football is more. But I think baseball still has a unique quality that connects us to every period of American history. So I think baseball is really special. I mean, it's my favorite game. I'm biased, I have to admit. I think it's the most perfect game ever invented. But I think the modern owners have kind of hurt it severely by the way the game is paced right now. it should be faster as in the old days.
Well, they talk about it a lot, but so far nothing really has happened. The other part of that question, by the way, was why was selling beer at the ballpark so important to people from St. Louis?
Oh, yes. Well, St. Louis was a city of immigrants. It had many German immigrants, and they specifically enjoyed going out with their families on Sundays and drinking beer. It was just a cultural thing. So Vanderay tapped right into, no pun intended, tapped right into that, and he got them out to the ballpark, and they had a grand time. So I think that was a big reason baseball took off in St. Louis and was so popular.
Well, that brings us right to a question from Lawrence, who is calling from Baden, an old German neighborhood. Let's bring him into the conversation. Go ahead, Lawrence, and thanks for waiting.
What was his brand of beer?
Oh, thanks, Lawrence. Well, it's hard to tell exactly, but there was a guy on his board of directors who was a brewer named Nolker, N-O-L-K-E-R. So I suppose he got all his beer from that guy, and he was an immigrant from Westphalia as well as Vanderay. So they were all friends, and they all helped each other out when they came to America, and I think that's what happened.
I've never heard of Nolker beer, that's why.
No, that must have been, and I haven't done extensive research into Nolker beer, but there was Budweiser back at the time, and that was a popular brand. But there were all sorts of, very small brewers, all over the city, and they were all madly competing for business. And this was obviously what Vanderay turned to this guy to help him make a lot of money selling beer.
I'll bet you there were several dozen different brands of beer, if you will, at that time. That was very typical in this country.
That's right, yeah.
Another call. This one, Rich will join us. Rich, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Don.
Hi,
hi Ed.
Hi, Rich.
I'm looking forward to reading your book. I'd like to, you had mentioned that Landera, as he is sometimes called, I mean, there's several ways to pronounce his name, but you had mentioned that he should be in the Hall of Fame, and I wholeheartedly agree, and I can't even get him a plaque on our own Walk of Fame. But I think the reason why this is the way it is that after the series of trade wars in the 1880s and early 1890s, when Vanderau was forced to join the National League, Spalding put his foot down on his throat and really kept him from doing anything. They took advantage of him, giving him bad trade, so he always finished him in the cellar in those last years. And it was this rather odd kidnapping caper in Pittsburgh that forced him out of the game, and Spalding, being the man that he was in baseball, worked diligently for the rest of his life, suppressing the color of the association past and concentrating on hardcore fundamentals and not letting anybody be any more colorful than he would allow. And this very much was successful in suppressing the name of Vanderau, and that even though David Quinton Voigt finds him prominent enough to mention in all three volumes of his history,
yes,
he was completely ignored by Ken Burns. I'm still miffed about that.
Oh, yeah. Burns missed a lot of stuff. But you really know your history, Rich. You really do.
Well, I wrote a paper on this about 25 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. I think that was one element of how he's sort of been forgotten by history. And the other is that, the prejudice against immigrants at the time, and they sort of went out, and he played into this too, but they went out of their way to present him as like this German boob who, just lucked into baseball. But he really wasn't that. He was a very crafty, clever, hardworking guy who really stimulated interest in the game. So I think it's sad that baseball's forgotten him as much as they have, and I hope this book goes some way to reminding people about him and reigniting interest in him.
I would also suggest to Rich that he contact Joe Edwards in University City about this Walk of Fame thing. They put out a list every year of people to be nominated for that, and maybe you can convince Joe to put Vondre's name on that list. So think about that, Rich.
Before, Don, and it's rather... rather Byzantine process.
Yeah, well, maybe Joe is listening to this program. I know he sometimes does and will not need to hear from you, but press that issue. Why don't you? By the way, I should point out that Vondre's Browns won four pennants from 1885 to 1888. Only Boston, the Yanks, and the Giants have done that since. Four in a row, that is. That's pretty
right.
Impressive. Pretty impressive.
That is very impressive. That's some sign of how this guy, although he didn't know all the details about baseball, he knew how to put together a good team. And that's quite an accomplishment.
We don't want to destroy the storyline that you have here. You deal with the pennant race of 1883, of which his team was very, very much involved. So I'm not going to bring up how that turned out so people read the book and be as surprised as I was at the ending of that. Back to the phones now. We'll have Mike join us from St. Louis. Mike, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. I had a question about what did it make a transition baseball from an amateur sport to a professional sport? And also, like, can you explain a little bit about how the power of advertising kind of spurred the sport along?
Sure. Well, the transition was in the 1860s and possibly a little bit before that, but generally in the 1860s. What happened was there were, and this is where we get the phrase clubs from, there were different clubs of people who liked to just get together and play baseball, and they started off as all amateur, you know, just guys having fun on the weekend. And then eventually they discovered if they brought in really good players, they could start selling tickets, and that would fund their operations and also fund their ballparks. And this sort of built on itself, and these teams started having all sorts of ringers on their teams, and they were paying them under the table since it was illegal to pay a professional. Finally, in 1869, the Cincinnati Reds formed what was the first all openly professional team, and they traveled the country and they won 65 games and lost none. So that sort of proved that having a professional team was an advantage. And from there, the National Association was created. That was the first real major league, and then the National League. You know the rest of the story.
While we're on this part of the subject matter, we have an email from Steve. He says, could you, Ed, please elaborate on black baseball in the 1880s? We alluded to that earlier. His book touches on the black stockings and Henry Bridgewater, he says.
Oh, that's right. Yes. St. Louis had one of the most prominent black professional baseball teams in the country. And as Steve mentions, Henry Bridgewater was a local saloon owner, was the owner of the team, and he led them around the country, and this was just wonderful coverage of this team, and they were impressive. The professional players, major league players, would come out and watch their games and pick up pointers on how to play. So that's part of the book, too.
Let's take another phone call. This time it'll be Anna calling from St. Louis. Anna, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. In 2011, when the Cardinals won the World Series, I happened to see an ad in the paper about a baseball game at White Cliff Park, which is close to Bush's Grant's Farm. And so I went to it. It was let me see what they call it. It was a vintage game.
That's right.
And it was played exactly like, you know, no gloves, no lines for where the outs were or anything. There was the bases. The umpire, who was called an arbitrator, stood in the back of the batter, and the catcher was behind the batter. And then the umpire stood way back behind the catcher, way back. I mean, like, 5 feet back,
yeah.
And he would. They did not call balls and strikes. He just was there to be sure that the person that was at bat was trying to hit the ball to the best of his ability. If he didn't hit the ball and he took so many balls, he'd call him out.
Yeah, well, that was an early. The vintage teams.
It was so exciting.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Oh,
the vintage
man.
Teams play under all these different rules, and they sort of follow the evolution of the game. And those, I'm sure, the game you saw was earlier than the period I'm writing about, because they did have balls and strikes in the period I'm writing about. I mean, the game was very similar to the modern game.
But it took seven balls to be walked.
That's right. It took seven balls to walk. And the pitcher in 1883 could not lift his arm above his shoulder. He had to throw sidearm or underarm, although a lot of them cheated and were throwing overhand anyway. And they pitched out of a box instead of a pitcher's mound. Front edge of the box was 50 feet from home plate. They could get kind of a running start and wing that ball in, and there was no penalty for hitting a batter with a pitch. So some of these pitchers could be really vicious. So it was very, very tough game in those days. But you've heard the phrase, you know, knocking the pitcher out of the box. Well,
oh,
that
yeah.
goes back to this era when there was a box instead of a mound.
Yeah. And the umpire, he had a real fancy brocaded vest on and a top hat. And he used a cane.
Well, I think some of that is a little exaggerated, but it may be, you know, true to the period, which was probably the 1860s game you were watching. The 1880s game, they had umpires with uniforms similar to today's. But there was only one umpire per game, and these players would try to cheat like mad on the umpire. Like if he turned his attention to right field to follow a baseball, the runner might go from second straight home without touching third if he could get away with it. And the crowd would be howling and carrying on. But if the umpire didn't see it, sometimes they got away with it.
You know, Ed, the one problem I had with your book was trying to visualize this jumping jack Dan Jones move to the plate. I couldn't figure out, even though you were describing it very well, I'm sure, what the heck was going on there? Can you help me out a little bit?
You know, I rolled out the book in Providence last night, and that was one of the questions. How did he get any speed on the ball if he was jumping up like a jumping jack? And I don't know. He somehow got it over the plate, and his motion was so crazy that the batters were distracted and had a tough time hitting him. Eventually they caught up with him, though, and started really clobbering him. But for a time, he did this amazing that's one of the parts of the book I love. He has the craziest pitching motion in baseball history, jumping up like a jumping jack with his arms and his legs thrown to the side. And this was actually captured. They didn't have photos in those days that could capture action in baseball. But his motion was captured in a very funny cartoon drawn by the Cincinnati Reds first baseman. And so it's there in the book. You can see what he looked like with his crazy motion.
The thing that I couldn't figure out was whether he let loose the ball while he was still in the air or when he came back down on the ground.
I think he must have, you know, flung it as he was doing this, you know, so... We'll see. Maybe in the movie version, they'll figure out how to throw the ball that way.
Is there going to be a movie version?
Well,
my
last one was optioned for a movie, but we'll see what happens with this one. You never know.
We only have about a minute left or a little bit less, and this is an impossible question to answer, I suppose, except do you think that some of these players, and you mentioned many of them in the book, Harry Stovey, for instance, sounded like a tremendous ball player. Do you think that those guys could make it today?
Oh, yes. Obviously players today have much better training, better medical care, and better diets and all that stuff, so they're better players. But I think any player from any era, if you gave them the same conditions, they would be just as good. And, you know, this Harry Stovey you mentioned, he was very fast runner, good thrower, you know, he's a good hitter, typical multi-talented player, and I think these people would thrive in any era. And they had the essential ingredient of being really competitive.
Ed Acorn, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It was a pleasure reading your book, and I'll remind folks once again that you'll be here next week on May 2nd at 7 p.m. at Left Bank Books downtown, and they'll be able to learn more from you about the book, and I strongly recommend it. It was a great read for me. I know it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don. All right.
tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air as a follow-up to our program earlier this month with author David Sheff about his books inspired by his son's drug addiction. We'll talk about the importance of the proper storage and disposal of prescription drugs. Then we'll take a look at a local organization's effort to honor the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King by preserving streets throughout the country which bear his name, including right here in St. Louis. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.